And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, Evelyn Lees. Good morning, Evelyn.
Good morning, Leslie. Well, our persistent faceted weak layer is still causing us trouble. Yesterday, there was a slide in Snake Creek called an area called Caribou Basin that was triggered by a snowmobiler. They weren't caught, but it does look like it stepped down into some weaker snow, and that'll be looked at today. There was some wind slab triggered yesterday, and if you look at the whole weekend, including the avalanche at Snow Basin, there were probably about 5 avalanches that released in those faceted weak layers that we have. And if you do trigger a slide on those weak layers, it could be 2 to 3 feet deep, 100 feet wide, and it's a very unpredictable, tricky avalanche situation. On Saturday, there was an avalanche in No Name Bowl, you know, on the Park City side, and there were 19 tracks, and the 20th run is what triggered that slide.
Wow.
And that person came out uninjured, too. But the best thing for people to do is continue to avoid those steep mid and upper elevation northerly through easterly facing slopes, because these avalanches are fairly unpredictable. And if you do trigger one, it's going to be large enough to bury you or injure you. The other thing to watch out for today is wind slabs. The winds are wonderfully light right now. We've got excellent powder out there, but that could be blown around along the high ridge lines. So wherever you are, if the winds start to pick up, and this would be like up on the Park City ridge line, Jupiter is blowing about 15 miles an hour with gusts to 20, and that's enough to create some soft wind drifts that should be avoided. So bottom line, the avalanche danger is moderate. But realize that means in isolated areas, big dangerous avalanches can be triggered, just not everywhere. So again, avoid those steep north through easterly facing slopes. And also watch out, as today's southwesterly winds increase, that there'll be some soft wind drifts along the ridge lines that you should avoid. And the best news is, you know, with all that great powder over the weekend, all the low angle slopes have filled back in, and so there's really good turning and riding on the lower angle slopes.
Okay, Evelyn, thank you.
Thanks.
It's Evelyn Lees with the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center.
This avalanche report is made possible by SkiUtah.com.
Well, the Utah Legislature's 45-day annual session kicks off this morning, 10 a.m. at the State Capitol. One of those who will be a fixture there over the next 45 days is Brian Schott, the managing editor of UtahPolicy.com, an online resource for residents, politicians, and leaders, or as they put it, the place where political junkies get their fix. Brian has agreed, again, to provide us with weekly updates through the session every Monday morning. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
So lots to talk about. For our segment this morning, let's hit on the highlights of what's to come over the next 45 days. The big one, of course, tax reform. We've been hearing about this for months, and I don't know if Utah leaders have really figured out the effects of the federal tax reform we'll have on Utah. So can we move forward with this?
Yeah, that's the big question right there. What's going to happen with federal tax reform and how that's going to affect the budget? What they do every year, it used to be that the governor's office would come up with a number of what the expected revenues, surpluses and such, they would come up with a number, and then the legislature would come up with their own number. In the past couple of years, they've gotten together and they come up with consensus numbers. They're going to do that again this year, but there is a fear that because they don't know what the federal tax reform is going to do, that they could miss one way or the other, and they could miss big. Nobody really knows what's going on, or no one knows for sure what's going to happen. So there is some confidence that they're going to be okay in their projections for the budget, but you know that's what the cloud that's hanging over this entire issue. So they're looking at tax reform, specifically a lot of sales tax reform. What they want to do is they're losing a lot of revenue because right now taxes are on goods. We do not tax services, and we're shifting to more of a service-based economy. So they're looking at ways to impose taxes. Like if you go to a lawyer, you don't pay taxes on those services. If you hire a house cleaner, you don't pay taxes on that. You don't pay a sales tax. They're looking at doing stuff like that. Netflix, another thing that you don't pay sales tax on. So they're trying to find a way to tax more services because the projections show that in a couple of years, probably probably 4 or 5 years, what we're taking in tax revenue under the current system is not going to be enough to cover the budget. So they have to, they see this big problem coming, and they're going to have to make some changes. Will they be able to do it? I'm not sure. It's an election year. I think they may, at least the people that I talk to, think that there's going to be some nibbling around the edges, but there's not going to be anything major passed.
Wow, I can't even imagine. Attorneys are expensive enough, but can you imagine here in Park City adding more than 9% to that attorney's bill? Jeez.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the issues, though. But we are more of a service-based economy now than a goods-based economy. And a lot of that is done online. So they're trying to find more ways to tax things that we buy online, because that's money you're supposed to pay to the state anyway when you buy goods online. They did enter into that agreement with Amazon. A lot of other places are voluntarily doing it, but that's another push that they're trying to get Congress to just step in and say, look, you can allow this. But yeah, they're talking a lot about services. Attorneys is one that they specifically bring up, so expect an effort there. You know, a lot of other these services that you don't pay a sales tax on, you might have to start doing that simply because the state needs to find new revenues or sources.
Yeah. So in addition to the sales tax, what else are we looking at? I mean, anything on food tax? I think Tim Quinn, representative here in Wasatch and Summit County, has talked about that.
Yeah, they've talked about the food tax. That was the discussion last year when they started to bite into tax reform late in the session, if you'll remember. One of the things that they talked about was putting the sales tax back on food, or the state portion of sales tax back on food. And when they ran the numbers, they found that that would not add as much money to the economy as they thought it would, specifically because of the number of exemptions that they were going to put into it. I don't know if they're going to touch the food tax this time. A lot of the noise is around sales tax. There's a lot of that stuff. We might see something with the gas tax because as people are switching to more fuel-efficient cars, they're not buying as much gas. Gas tax is simply a user fee for using the roads, because the gas tax goes to pay for the roads. What they've been doing to make up for a shortfall in that road construction is raiding the general fund. They've been taking money out of the general fund to pay for roads. They need to find a way to fix that imbalance as well. So another sneaky thing that they're talking about is there's probably going to be more user fees implemented on things or raised to help the state meet their budget. I mean, the problem is, if you look at what's going on with the budget, they said that the revenue right now is pointing towards around a $370 million surplus, but that money's already spoken for. It's already going in certain places. Statutorily, it has to go into some rainy day funds, has to go some other places. And actually, as they start the base budgeting process here on day one, they're $21 million in the hole, actually. So they need to find places to cut. They always do this. They do efficiencies. They try to find these inefficiencies and cut them out of the budget, and then they go from there. But there's not a lot of extra money to go around.
So, of course, Republicans in the State House have the supermajority. Where's this notion of small government?
Well, yeah, especially when you look at it. Right now they are on track to, again, open a record number of bill file requests. At last count, it was well over 1,200. But those are just requests. The number of bills that we will probably see introduced into the session will be somewhere around 900 to 1,000, as they usually do. They'll pass somewhere around 500 of them. Yeah, so, I mean, there's not a notion of, I mean, everyone talks about smaller government, more efficient government, but they don't do it. Just because, you know, we've got a state with a $16 billion budget. You can't really have a small government when your budget is that large.
Right, right. I guess when I start hearing about, you know, the user fees and the taxes increased, I mean, that's pretty much against everything Republicans stand for, no?
Well, it's sort of a Sophie's choice. They have to raise the money somewhere. So what are they going to do? Are they going to do a user fee, or are they going to raise your taxes? It's an election year. They're not going to raise your taxes. The other thought behind the sales tax is they raise the sales tax. People aren't really going to notice that. I mean, you'll notice it on if they're putting sales taxes on things they've never done before. But you're not really going to notice it because it's year-round. You notice things like an income tax hike. You'll notice a property tax hike because when that bill comes due, it's all in one chunk. You don't notice the sales tax. You don't really notice the user fees. And that's a way to raise the state revenue without actually having to do a tax hike.
Okay, another issue is UTA governance. Why is this important?
Well, I spoke with Speaker Greg Hughes, and he's been on the UTA board, and they're just looking for ways to basically fix the public perception of the Utah Transit Authority. They point out that they've got a part-time board who are basically trying to do a full-time job. Former Lieutenant Governor Greg Bell is now the chairman of the UTA board, and he's going to do some things to sort of help their public perception. But if you look at what's going on with the UTA, one out of every $4 they spend goes to servicing $2 billion in debt that they have. That's a lot of debt. So, there's no one really has a path forward as to what's going to happen. I know that Speaker Hughes favors creating a three-member board appointed by the governor, confirmed by the legislature. That would provide some accountability on this whole thing. It's going to be a big fight. Speaker Hughes pointed to it as one of the sleeper issues that could hijack the government, and I expect that to happen as well.
Let's move to school funding. Besides state personnel, I'm thinking this is the biggest state expenditure?
It's one of the largest, and they're staring down the barrel of the Our Schools Now initiative, and that is a hike in the personal income tax and in the sales tax to provide an estimated $700 million per year for schools. That looks to get on the ballot here in 2018. Lawmakers, they really don't have a counter for it. They're not going to be able to do anything aside from a massive tax hike to even come close to that kind of a funding increase. Governor Herbert has proposed around $200 million in new money. This, a lot of that is eaten up by growth. Our schools are growing, and you have to cover that. We're going to have 30,000 new students in schools next year. So, and that is on top of the people who are going to graduate out of the school. So you're going to have a class leave the public school system at the end of the year, but you're going to have 30,000 more students come into the system than left the system. So our schools are growing. The funding is not keeping up with the needs. We have a teacher shortage everywhere. They're just trying to find ways to get more money for schools. One of the things that they're talking about is right now, anytime that a school board wants to raise property taxes to help pay for schools, and this is a local entity, or put a bond, they have to go through a truth in taxation hearing. And lawmakers have discovered that those truth in taxation hearings kind of have a chilling effect. A lot of times these things don't get passed. But they're trying to make it so that these school boards can do hikes in tax rates, a modest hike in the tax rates to keep up with some of the funding pressures without having to go through a truth in taxation hearing. They won't be able to do it if they're proposing a massive bond or a massive tax hike, but if they're trying to, sort of keep up with inflation a little bit, they won't have to go through those truth in taxation hearings, and they're hoping that that's going to help this out. They're also going to be looking at school district funding equalization, help out some of the poorer school districts, take money away from the larger districts to sort of help out with that. But school funding is a big issue, and it's going to take up a lot of the oxygen up here.
Okay. Finally, wanted to just touch on medical marijuana. I think we're still waiting for some research on this, but it seems like there's lots of support growing for at least looking into it from some unsuspecting candidates like Governor Herbert and Senator Orrin Hatch.
Well, this is all a response to the proposed ballot initiative that would legalize medical cannabis, non-smokable medical cannabis. Lawmakers realize that if this thing gets on the ballot, it is going to pass. So they are trying to find ways to sort of mute that. Right now, there are at least five bills proposed that would sort of do things that this ballot initiative wants to do. The backers of the ballot initiative, they don't really want to compromise at all. I'm hearing rumblings of a bill that's out there. I can't really give you many of the details, but I'm hearing rumblings that there may be an effort to sort of do an SB 54 thing on the medical marijuana bill. And the legislature may try to completely head off that initiative, because there's a lot of people who say that the initiative is written poorly. It has some unintended consequences. I've heard people say that it allows for people to grow marijuana in their own homes. And some people might have some objections to that. So you're going to see a big fight about this. Lawmakers are urging caution. Governor Herbert wants to study more. Senator Orrin Hatch wants to study it more. But the people on the other side who are trying to push this ballot initiative, they say, you know, people are suffering. The time for studying is over.
Yeah, still, I guess just even no matter what the state legislature does, it doesn't impact what could happen in November, right? I mean, if that initiative passes, it passes.
Yeah, but think about it this way. If the initiative passes, it's not going to make it legal right away. The state is going to have to come up with a way to regulate the sale of medical marijuana, license growers. It will be at least 18 months to 2 years after that thing passes before we see any sort of result. And lawmakers could easily pass a bill up here that would say, okay, you can only get medical marijuana through a state-licensed pharmacy. If that happens, you're not going to be able to get medical marijuana because state-licensed pharmacies cannot sell that to people because it's a Tier 1 drug, right? So there are ways to sort of blunt this, and there has been talk of that happening. I don't think they're going to make a draconian measure like that, but I do think lawmakers are going to say, look, you're going to have to wait 18 months, 2 years if you pass this thing before anything happens. We're going to try to find a way to do what you're trying to do right away, start the process now rather than next year after this passes, because it won't go into effect until January 1st, right? So they want to find a way to say, we're going to help you now, and we're going to write this thing better. Because if you look at the difference between what the legislature does and what initiative does, initiative, it can only be done in very broad strokes, and there's a lot of unintended consequences. The legislature can be more targeted. Everyone says the legislature should be the ones to do this because they're able to make changes, fix things. An initiative can't.
Okay. Brian, always some good information. Appreciate your time this morning. Good luck in the next 45 days. Brian Schade, the managing editor of UtahPolicy.com. Again, you can go to the website and sign up for these daily emails. It's 8:28. The Park City Council meets in a special meeting tomorrow in the studio with a preview of the agenda. I have Park City Manager Diane Foster, hoping to have Matt Dias join us here on the phone. He's down at the Utah State Legislature. So good morning to you, Diane.
Good morning.
At 5:30, the council will get an update on one of its critical priorities, transportation. This is looking at the State Road 248 corridor improvements. Now, we knew a study was underway by Park City and UDOT. What did we find out?
We found out, number one, that the rail trail has an endangered species on it, and also that the 248 corridor, the existing corridor, is most definitely the best route to use to explore options that could include an HOV lane or other type of way to get HOV, in particular a bus, in here more quickly than getting just somebody in a single occupancy vehicle in. So this was this is an extremely long process. You know, our water system is quite complex, and I compared that to this particular project because we saw a graphic of this project a couple weeks ago, and the flow chart on it was actually more complicated than our entire water system. So it is quite an exciting project, and this is really just a quick 30-minute update for council on where we are in this project. The other piece about this one is that We're looking to front load part of the project, and that is in particular the Hawk Beacon that is right by the high school. And I can tell you from seeing it multiple times every day, that does significantly slow down traffic, both in the morning and as well as the outload. And it's particularly noticeable during Sundance, where there's a lot of pedestrian traffic there. Now, we have heard from our transportation planning folks. Julia Collins was talking a couple weeks ago about the fact that there is, you know, when we put the Comstock Tunnel in, that was a huge success, and that's a heavily utilized tunnel, and that really helped the traffic flow, particularly in the morning. This section, the Hawk Beacon by the seminary and the high school, has three times the amount of pedestrian traffic that we have over at that we had at Comstock. So this is something that there's a possibility it could go in this summer. A lot of that will depend on the bidding, which we always know that right now the construction season's kind of rough.
So, again, the rail trail was a huge issue, and it will not be used as a transportation corridor other than for bicycles then. That's
correct. And actually, in talking to the transportation planning people, it was actually really important that the rail trail was included, not only because it is actually a requirement so we can get federal funding, that everything be considered in the NEPA process, and because the rail trail had been identified in a study a long time ago, we actually, by law, if we wanted federal funding, had to do that. But also, because they found an endangered species, it actually protects the rail trail to even a greater extent from future development.
Okay. Well, and of course, anybody who drives in and out of 248 during the commuter times, they know there are some real challenges. I think an interesting finding is that we've seen traffic increasing significantly, almost 28% in the last 2 years, single occupancy vehicles making up 80% of that traffic. So again, that goes back to the whole idea of we got to get people on different transportation.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the huge successes of this year, you know, anytime you launch something new, like a new route, you expect it to take 2 to 3 years to kind of ramp up and people to get used to it. In addition to the Electric Express from Kimball Junction being an enormous success, we have found that the Camas commuter has been wonderful. And Sundance, we've gotten, just like at the Homestake lot with Main Street employees, with the Camas commuter, we've got a lot of new trial during Sundance because people, it's maybe the first opportunity where they don't have a place to park that's free. So we've been super encouraged with that.
So staff, I think, will be developing this more at the February 10th meeting. Is that it?
There'll be more on this for the next couple years.
Okay. Let's jump, because we've got Matt Dias now on the phone. Let's jump to the Treasure Hill CUP. Matt, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so possible action is on the agenda for the City Council for the proposed settlement agreement. How likely is that?
Well, that decision and that authority is ultimately up to the Planning Commission. I think for the benefit of the listeners, we will have for the first time an actual road alignment, that we have two engineering firms that have come to an agreement that work in terms of cuts into the hillside, meeting the fire code grade, two sections of ingress and egress. And so for the first time, we actually have a road alignment that may work. It will also lay out the potential siting of the hotel. We intend to have massing and scale of the potential hotel, as well as a relative design of where the single-family subdivision may go. So the good news is, for the first time, we have a road that may potentially work for their consideration, and all of the impacts that go with that can be calculated.
Okay,
the size of retaining walls.
All right, we just don't have a lot of time for that.
The extent of excavation.
Let me.
Let me just ask that
we're talking about three different ones. Which one do we have? The one, two, or three in terms of the least road cuts, the middle road cuts, or the most road cuts?
Well, we have option C, which I think is probably the middle in terms of the road excavation and the level of excavation.
Okay. Now, you said that this is up to the Planning Commission. I understand that. That's the development agreement. But what's before the City Council is the settlement agreement, and that's what I asked about. How likely is something like that getting approved now?
Excuse me. Well, the City Council has been very clear that they'd like the Planning Commission to go first, that they want them to review the specifics of the potential development agreement and either give them a head nod or an affirmative ratification that they want the Council to move forward and purchase down half the density. So So that's so the first meeting would be City Council on Tuesday evening, and we would be presenting, by and large, the same information that we're presenting to the Planning Commission the following evening.
So is this information online yet? I mean, because what we've seen is that the staff reports, are, there's nothing there until the meeting, you know, before the Planning Commission.
No, that's a very fair question. We plan to have a very comprehensive staff report out later today, and regrettably so, this has been such tense negotiation as we're coming down the wire that we haven't been able to get staff reports out ahead of time, but we do hope to have one by close of business today, and it should be very, very comprehensive, Leslie. So it should have all sorts of information about housing and parking requirements, siting, excavation, size of retaining walls, road alignments, and so we're really excited for the first time. We think we have a package of information with a type of specificity that we've been desiring all along and to answer many of the questions the public and the Planning Commission has been asking.
Okay, so do you expect to see approval of both the settlement agreement and development agreement by the 31st?
Well, I think that's still our goal. I think if we got to a point where we had materially or substantially complete agreements and we had head nods from the City Council and the Planning Commission, I think that the attorneys would then be put to work drawing up the final documents. And so that's really what we're looking for, is to try to see if we can get to a place with the Planning Commission and City Council where they think that staff and the applicant have a proposal that is far better than the alternative, which was the kind of original treasure application for the CUP, the 17.2 version.
Okay. Hey, Matt, I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks so much.
Diane, back to you. Also at 6 o'clock, the council's scheduled to appoint a new city council member to fill the unexpired term of Mayor Andy Bierman. Has the council decided on who that's going to be?
I believe the council has narrowed the choice, but they will make that decision at the meeting and they will actually vote on that person.
Okay, so how has that choice been narrowed? It hasn't happened in a meeting.
That is true. By state law, they actually can, because of personnel, under state law, you can talk about security, personnel, property, and litigation in a closed session. And so under personnel, they have discussed the candidates, and they have narrowed the field, but they won't make a decision until tomorrow.
Okay, that's in direct contradiction to what Jeff Hunt, a media attorney, sent to KPCW to support our argument that the Park City Council cannot discuss the vacancy in a closed session. And this is Utah Code 52-4-205, Purposes of Closed Meetings. And it says, in a closed meeting, a public body may not interview a person applying to fill an elected position. And we saw that happen, interviews in open session. B, discuss filling a midterm vacancy or temporary absence, and this is governed by Title 28, Chapter 1, blah, blah, blah. And C, discuss the character, professional competence, or physical or mental health of a person whose name was submitted for consideration to fill a midterm vacancy. So sounds to me like...
So what you just read, right, was the opinion of an attorney. The language that was in there is very specific to state code that says you can talk about the character of a person, the competency, and those are the specific things that city council... discussed in closed session.
No, this says that you may do that.
I believe you just read me, though, the opinion of the attorney, not the state law itself.
No, I'm reading you the state code.
What I'll do is I'll get with City Attorney Mark Harrington. We've actually spent a significant amount of time going through state code, and we even reviewed it with the city council, and we'll get back to you.
Okay, well, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that if this was an election, we would be talking about all of these candidates' strengths and weaknesses. So why would a midterm fulfillment be any different than a public election?
It is very different. State code allows the city council. It specifies that the city council in a midterm election, it's not a vote of the people. It's that the city council has the requirement to fill that seat and that they alone have that authority and responsibility. So it is, I believe, we're conducting everything in public that we are required by law to do. And I actually think it's actually a kinder process that, city council has an amazing group of candidates, 15 people have thrown their hat in the ring. And these are people from all walks of life across the community who are willing to give their time. And what City Council wants to do is talk about, and they've given criteria in public for what they thought, what they believe is are the qualifications that they want to see in someone. Someone who does have broad experience in the community. They want to make sure that if at all possible, that the secondary criteria included that they filled a gap that might be needed on the council.
Okay, so it may be kinder, but here, I'm going to send that with
will,
you.
I will take that, and I'll talk with City Attorney Mark Harrington. We'll get back to you today. Okay. I did want to mention that we do have a 90-minute study session on social equity, and we've got an action plan, a six-point action plan that we'd very much like the opportunity to discuss with City Council. Now, it isn't slated for public input, and it is 90 minutes of council discussion on that. Also, did want to mention that if you are coming to the City Council meeting, when you come in, you want to tell the parking attendant that you're going to the meeting, and you will receive a validation, and you'll put that in your dashboard so that we'll know you're attending the meeting.
Yeah. Let's talk quickly. So city staff who have to attend council meetings or planning commission meetings, are they having to pay for their parking like any Main Street employee would have to?
The validations are available to city staff and to council members. Now, if a staff member is working, so if you're working at night, so I've paid for parking at night, but if you're specifically there to attend a council meeting, we have done validations.
Okay, even though that's their job?
Yeah, even though that's their job, yes.
Okay, so how is that, why do they get special treatment then? Because again, you know, the chef here across the street, that's his job to be at the restaurant, but he's still required to pay.
Well, actually, the restaurant could choose, just like the city did, the restaurant could choose to pay for that parking for that employee for that. And this is, you know, we don't consider, most city staff don't get paid extra for working extra hours like a chef would. And so the city council believes that the city actually pays for those. So those aren't just like a comp or it doesn't exist in the system. So we actually pay for those and then the employee doesn't have to pay for it. So the restaurant could do the same thing. They could say, hey, we're going to pay for the employee to park.
Except that we're paying for the employee to park and I'm not paying for the chef to park. As a city taxpayer, I'm paying for city staff.
Sure, but we're 80% of we're 80% of our funding for taxes. 80 to 85% of our revenue comes from the visitor. I would argue that the visitor is paying 85 cents and the local is paying 15 cents.
Okay, leave it there, Diane. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now 8:46. Still to come, we'll be talking with Brian Hatton. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now 8:46. Joining me now in the studio with an update on the Snyderville Basin Special Recreation District, I have District Director Brian Hatton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. We've got a controlled burn happening in Toll Canyon. When and where is this going
to
be?
Yeah, we just wanted to let people know. A couple years ago, we had some fire mitigation done back there, and we have a bunch of slash piles that the fire warden is going to burn. A lot of it depends on weather conditions. It needs to pretty much be ideal with good snowfall, which we finally have. And the air quality. So they gave us a range between the end of January and February. So if they start seeing some things in Toll Canyon happening, smoke and things like that, hopefully it's our fire warden taking care of the slash piles back there.
Okay, so I'm just wondering that it's not covered by snow and it is burnable?
It's probably covered right now, but with I don't know the total process. They'll probably clear it away so they can get to it and then just let it sit for a few days and then try to get rid of it.
Okay. You've got some closures at the field house for Sundance happening. Tell us when and where those are going to be.
Yeah, we have the closing party for Sundance. The party is on Saturday the 27th, but we start with a setup process. Thursday in the evening around 7 o'clock, the field will close, and any classes that we have on the field will be closed. On Friday, after 2, the gym will be closed. The other areas, the fitness areas, are still available to be open, and the classes are going on that aren't on the field. On Saturday, just after 1, the whole facility will be closed down, and then the true finalized setup for Sundance Party will take place. But we have it back open Sunday morning with the classes in the fitness areas, and the track will be open all day. And then After 2, the gym will be back open, and after 7, the field will be back open. So a little minor interruption, but hopefully the people are okay with everything.
Okay. Let's talk briefly about some of the upcoming projects and plans for your goals for the coming year.
For some projects we have coming up, I mean, some minor things. We're doing some parking lots at Trailside Park. We're going to be adding the trail in Toll Canyon, expanding our bike park a little bit, some planning for Silver Creek Village, the 100-acre park that we're looking to start to get a little more of that process going. And we're going to have a community open house in May, giving everybody the opportunity to see what we're doing, stopping in at the field house and seeing what's going on, providing input there. And some goals, a lot of it goes with the open house is a lot of master planning, trying to tighten up our trails master plan. I think the last time we did that was in 2006. We've made some iterations to it, but want to drill it down a little bit more. We are acquiring more open space, so we want to try to develop a good plan for that moving forward, and maintenance and how we plan to operate that. Parks and sustainability is a big thing that we want to do, is just making sure this we're moving forward in a sustainable way for the community and for the environment, and just trying to do different things like that.
So in terms of capital facilities, what are we looking at that other than maybe Silver Creek, huh?
Silver Creek Village is pretty much our big thing. 100 acres, we can do a lot of different things there. We don't have a facility planned. We'll use some of the old studies that we've done. I think they were back in 2011 and 2012 about what facilities the community would like to see. We've been able to help with a little bit, but we haven't knocked off the big three. So more indoor field space, an aquatic center, and there's one more I can't think of right now. So we have the big three that we want to try to get that somehow, just to help the community find those recreational outlets for them.
Okay. So again, those open houses are coming up when?
Beginning of May. Mm-hmm. So we'll have all of our operations going on there, probably some of our community partners. We're looking to do more with arts and recreation and gardening as recreation and working with an all-inclusive type of a opportunity for the community, making sure we're including everybody in what we do.
Okay. Real quick, wanted to get, we have talked about this for years now, a safe crossing over or under 224. Where do things stand? I know you've budgeted money for that.
Yes. Yeah. We passed a couple of the last two bonds. There was some money set aside for a crossing on 224. What we're looking at is the county is doing a transportation study. It was put on hold a little bit last year. The transportation person for the county had twins, so it slowed the process. But we hope to revamp that back up and get an idea. We're working with the county. We're working with UDOT to try to find what's the best aspect or best area, with the canyon's lower village really building up. It might move down that way a little bit. We just want to make sure that we're doing the right thing and not just putting something into a place that maybe is used minimally compared to where it could be in a more effective area. But hopefully this study will show us that, and we'll do it right.
When do you expect to have that done then?
Hopefully by the end of the year, the study will be done, and we'll have a better plan of attack for that crossing.
Okay, Brian. Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
8:52 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Joining me now on the phone from U.S. Ski and Snowboard,
Hi.
Tom Kelly. Good morning, Tom.
Well, good morning, Leslie, and just heading back from the Toyota U.S. Grand Prix in Mammoth, but I understand that you got some snow in Park City.
Yeah, finally. So where are we then with Olympic selection?
Well, the Olympic selection period closed yesterday, so now over the next few days, as we are now less than 20 days out to the opening ceremony, our officials and coaches from each of the teams will be going through the quotas that we received this morning from the International Ski Federation to try to apply those to our selection. So we've already qualified around 53 athletes based on objective criteria. We anticipate a team of around 105 to 110 athletes in skiing and snowboarding. That'll be a part of a U.S. delegation that's expected to be around 225. So nearly half of the athletes coming from U.S. ski and snowboard. And we'll begin those formal team announcements probably later today or more likely tomorrow and continue through Thursday. And then on this Friday, the U.S. Olympic Committee will formally name Team USA that will go to Pyeongchang for the Olympics starting on February 9th.
Okay, well, let's talk about, boys, some craziness with the Kitzbühel downhill.
Well, it always is pretty crazy. And we had Stephen Nyman on 15th, and he was pretty disappointed with that run. But, you know, and looking at what he's come back from with the injury last season, the fact that he's able to compete there at all was pretty amazing. So most of us look at that and say, hey, good on you, Stephen, for that finish. And meanwhile, down south in Cortina, Italy, a really important event for the women's team, Lindsey Vonn winning her 79th World Cup, and with that clinching a spot on the Olympic team. Julia Mancuso also announcing her retirement. She's been plagued with injuries, most notably a hip problem that has just really, really hampered her the last few years. She gave it a good go, was in a number of events this year, and finally this week decided to call it a career. And what a star-studded career it was. Four Olympic Games. She has 9 major championship medals, including an Olympic gold from 2006. And we're going to miss her and miss her spirit, but she's going to be in the broadcast booth for NBC in Pyeongchang. So we'll still have Julia to contribute her amazing, fun lifestyle to our sport.
Yeah, had she thought that she might make a return to the Olympics? Or was it, you know, I mean...
She was fully motivated to get back and make a 5th Olympic team and worked really hard this past summer. Her on snow training had been delayed a number of times because of the injury, but she finally did get back on snow this fall. She felt okay. She had good days and bad days. A couple of races she tried to get in and just really wasn't able to. And eventually she did get some race starts in. And as she got to Cortina, a course that she really loves, she just started to look at the depth on the women's team right now. And I mean, to give you an example, Lindsey Vonn won the race on Saturday, and that was the first time she'd been able to clinch a spot. Lindsey was actually the number 6th in the rankings going into that event. So it's a strong and deep U.S. women's team, and Julia saw that it was really not that likely she was going to be competitive and make that team, and decided that she would retire. And she went out a typical Julia style, wearing her spider superwoman suit and a cape, heading down the course to Cortina and getting the well wishes of all of us on the World Cup Tour.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the Mammoth U.S. Grand Prix. So this was, again, another Olympic qualifier. Tell me about Josh Christensen. He failed to earn a spot, or he still has another chance?
Josh is pretty much out right now, and the Toyota U.S. Grand Prix was the primary selection tool for the U.S. free ski and the U.S. snowboarding Olympic team. And particularly in free ski this year, the criteria was up, so you needed to have 2 top 3 finishes against the entire world field in order to qualify by objective criteria. Josh, as folks in Park City know, injured his knee at the end of last season. It was a pretty significant injury, and he kind of weighed his options at that point and decided that he would give it a good go and try to get back and make the Olympic team. Finally was able to get on snow earlier this winter, got in the Grand Prix at Aspen Snowmass last weekend, and it was tough going at first, but he actually qualified for the first of 2 slopestyle events for the men on Sunday at Mammoth Mountain. For a while, he was sitting in the number 3 position, dropped down to 4th, and dropped down to 5th. So with that 5th place finish, he no longer had an opportunity to get 2 top 10s. He still felt that he could get it on discretion. Went into the 2nd event yesterday, and he was sitting on the bubble in qualifying, and eventually with the last rider down in qualifying, Josh got bumped out. So he lost his spot in the finals, and with it, pretty much any realistic opportunity of making the team.
Yeah. All right, and let's talk a little bit about Park City's Alex Hall and McRae Williams. They still don't know if they're going or not?
No, they didn't achieve the criteria, so we've still got a few spots left. It was interesting. That criteria proved really difficult, and on the men's slopestyle side, we actually didn't get our first qualifier until yesterday. Nick Gepper finally qualified after the first competition yesterday, which was number 4 of 5 in the qualifying series. And then in the second one, Gus Kenworthy getting his spot with a really amazing, amazing finish. So Alex and McRae were definitely right in there. There are still 2 spots to be named by discretion onto that men's slopestyle team, and that will take place probably sometime in the next 2 days.
Okay. Cross country, have we named that team?
We have quite a few qualifiers on that team. This has been the strongest season we've ever had, particularly on the women's side right now. That team will be named later this week, and we anticipate upwards of 20 people to be on that team. Top ones right now on this weekend, Jesse Diggins with a career-best fifth in the classic sprint in Planica, Slovenia. And what's interesting about that is that the sprint event at the Olympics is classic technique this time, and we've been a little concerned about that because our forte has been freestyle. But this year, Jesse Diggins has had a great season in classics, so has Sophie Caldwell. She's standing third in the World Cup sprint standings right now. So looking forward to that, and a very strong team that we're going to name this week. Jesse Diggins and Sadie Bjornsson, both top 10 in the world right now. Jesse in third in the overall rankings. So very confident we're taking a strong team, especially on the women's side, to Pyeongchang.
Okay, and in ski jumping, this is interesting. Sarah Hendrickson won the winner-take-all here at the Utah Olympic Park. Park City's Abby Ringquist, however, leads the World Cup ranking. So does that qualify her?
Well, we don't know. It depends on the quotas and how they're applied. But I think things look really good for Abby right now. Sarah, as you said, Leslie, qualifying by the Olympic trials, and she will be going to Pyeongchang. She's had some struggles on the World Cup. She did get a finish this weekend, but really not jumping at the level that she would like to. But she's also a really good big event skier, so I wouldn't count her out for the Olympics, and she is going to Pyeongchang. The remainder of the team depends on the number of quota spots that we get, and that process is underway right now. The next selection criteria is World Cup rankings, and right now Abby leads in that category. So fingers crossed, we'll know in a few days who's going to fill out that team, and I anticipate we'll probably announce that team coming up this Thursday.
Okay. Anything else, Tom?
No, just an exciting time of year, less than 20 days to Pyeongchang. So enjoy the powder up in Park City, folks, and stay tuned the next few days as we announce all of our Olympians going to Pyeongchang.
Okay. Thanks, Tom.